March 1965, after months of top-secret debate, President Lyndon Johnson and Robert Strange McNamara, his Secretary of Defense, decided to override the advice of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and launched what they claimed would bring Ho Chi Minh to negotiate and end hostilities in the Republic of Vietnam. They called it Operation Rolling Thunder. I'm Oliver North, and in this War Stories podcast, you'll hear the voices of those who made the fateful decisions to fight the growing war in Vietnam with a policy of gradual escalation and ironclad White House control over targets and the rules of engagement. Fearing retaliation from the Soviet Union and Communist China, LBJ and McNamara dictated all the terms for U.S. airstrikes. Never before had a U.S. president been so involved in target selection, aircraft types, weapons, even tactics. You'll learn why many of the courageous U.S. Air Force, Navy, and Marine pilots who flew increasingly dangerous missions over North Vietnam cynically referred to Rolling Thunder as Rolling Blunder. Our pilots were forced to watch enemy surface-to-air missile sites being built, unable to attack them until the enemy fired first. Communist MiG fighter jets could be attacked only after they took off, and many of Ho Chi Minh's airfields were off limits for more than 3 years on orders from America's commander-in-chief. You'll hear eyewitness accounts of how the skies over North Vietnam became a proving ground for new Soviet weapons and tactics as parts of the country became the most heavily defended airspace in the history of warfare. Increasing numbers of MiGs, surface-to-air missiles, and anti-aircraft guns awaited every U.S. strike mission. In this compelling podcast of war stories, you'll meet pilots George Bud Day and Paul Galanti. Shot down over North Vietnam, they spent a combined 12 years in brutal captivity. If you aren't inspired by the dramatic firsthand report on how Air Force legend Robin Olds staged a modern Trojan horse in Operation Bolo, you have to be numb from the shoulders up. And if the remarkable story of Bob Pardo's push in one of aviation's most dramatic and dangerous rescues doesn't make your heart race, get to a hospital right now because you're having a cardiac event. For all the rest of you red-blooded Americans who cherish keeping company with heroes, hang on. You're about to hear from the American heroes of Rolling Thunder.
The men who flew this plane call it the Thud or the Lead Sled. The U.S. Air Force called it the F-105 Thunder Chief, and during the Vietnam War, it was a workhorse. I'm Oliver North. Welcome to War Stories. Coming to you tonight from the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. Between 1961 and 73, over 3,000 aircraft like this one were shot down or destroyed in Southeast Asia. 1968, the last year of Rolling Thunder, and 652 men piloting these planes lost their lives. From March of 65 to October of 68, Air Force, Navy, and Marine airmen logged roughly a million sorties over North Vietnam, dropping a half million tons of bombs. Impressive, but Rolling Thunder was far from a triumph. As you'll see and hear in this War Stories episode, orders straight from the White House forced the men flying these missions to fight with one hand tied behind their backs. And those restrictions inevitably cost American lives. Join us tonight as we pay tribute to the heroes of Operation Rolling Thunder.
Boom, they opened up. Hosing us down as we're coming in. It took this huge hit. Every warning light came on. Nothing to do but punch.
Could this war have been won?
Of course it could. It could have ended any time we wanted to.
In 1965, Vietnam was divided and at war. The South was democratic and America's friend. The North, communist and allied with our Cold War enemies, the Soviet Union and China. Ho Chi Minh ruled the North with a singular purpose, an independent, unified, and communist Vietnam.
Well, I thought it was the right thing to do to take the communists on.
George Day grew up 7,000 miles from Vietnam on the banks of the Sioux River in Iowa.
After the war, he switched to the Air Force and by Vietnam had already flown combat missions in the Korean War.
It really started with Charlie Lindbergh. He was my all-consuming hero. And we used to throw parachutes up in the air, a handkerchief with a rock tied to it, and yell, "Charlie Lindbergh."
Jackie Cochran Odlum, who was the first woman to break the sound barrier, came to our little town of Corona. She talked to me, invited me down to a ranch in Indio, California, and really was a mentor to me.
Years later, Jack McEncrow would thank Cochran by giving her his first set of Marine Corps wings. His first assignment was to the Marine Corps Air Station, El Toro, California.
I said, "I want to be a fighter pilot." He said, "We have one slot left in VMFA 122. They're going to Vietnam in August." I said, "That'd be great."
By 1965, the Beatles and Rolling Stones had invaded America, and there were thousands of American military advisors in South Vietnam. Early that year, President Lyndon Johnson decided to drastically but quietly increase America's commitment to the South and its leader, Thieu Nguyen Van. And the public agreed. Polls showed that 80% of Americans supported helping South Vietnam.
The advance of communism had to be stopped.
Jim McInerney began his military career as a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne. By the Korean War, he decided it was better to land them than jump out of them.
I had the high honor indeed of getting credit for the last big kill of the Korean War.
Rolling Thunder was an extraordinarily cautious bombing campaign. It reflected the caution of the guy who ran it, President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson.
Wayne Thompson is the author of To Hanoi and Back, A History of the Air War Over Vietnam. It was only declassified by the Air Force in 1997.
The insurgency in South Vietnam was being run from Hanoi, and so Johnson reluctantly agreed to a very limited bombing campaign.
Gradualization basically violates every known rule of war.
Principal airfields in North Vietnam were not permitted to be bombed for over 2 years. The capital city of Hanoi was barely bombed for years. Soviet ships could come into Haiphong and unload supplies.
Roughly two-thirds of North Vietnam's imports came through the port of Haiphong. Closing the port would have crippled the enemy, but White House restrictions allowed the supplies to keep flowing. And that wasn't all. Pilots were virtually forbidden from attacking enemy SAM sites. Those are surface-to-air missile sites.
The inability to go after a SAM site until it was fully built and operational and fired at us because of the political danger that McNamara and Johnson felt we would pick up if we killed a couple of Russians.
And we didn't want to hurt the Russian advisors.
That's right, we didn't want to make them mad.
When Rolling Thunder began in March of 1965, Dave Brog, Howard Scrappy Johnson, and thousands of men like them were forced to fight by rules like these.
Who picked the targets that you'd go off and hit?
The Tuesday lunch bunch. That's President Johnson and Secretary McNamara and I think four or five other civilians.
In the skies over North Vietnam, Texan Bob Pardo would see the price of hesitation by the Tuesday lunch bunch. This is a conversation between Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara and LBJ on the eve of Rolling Thunder.
As I told you yesterday, it'd be unwise to go on the first. I would stir up the Russians and push them close to the Chinese. We're getting a little pressure from the field indicating a lack of understanding of why we're doing what we're doing.
Lyndon Johnson had well remembered the Chinese intervention in the Korean War, and he was really very fearful that they might bring in full divisions to combat American forces.
Where did you grow up?
I was an Army brat. My brother was West Point. My father-in-law was career Army. My brother-in-law is West Point, class of 66.
Paul Galani bucked family tradition and graduated from the Naval Academy in 1962.
The Cold War is very much on the minds of certainly people at the Naval Academy.
Well, that's what it was. We just knew that sooner or later we're going to cross horns with the Ruskies or the Chinese communists and bash heads and have a big war with them.
Galani flew the skies of North Vietnam in an A-4.
The throwaway bomber, the tinker toy, the scooter. Official name, of course, was the A-4 Skyhawk.
But the A-4 also had a nuclear mission.
Oh, yeah.
Many of the aircraft that flew into North Vietnam were designed with an entirely different war and mission in mind.
we got more and more and more embroiled with the cold, so-called Cold War. And the mission of the Air Force became one of nuke retaliation, nuke threat, nuke this, nuke that. There was a long period where actual fighter tactics and conventional warfare were not really considered.
1943 West Point graduate Robin Olds became an ace during World War II. His experience dropping unguided so-called dumb bombs on the Nazis would prove vital to the pilots flying jets over Vietnam.
The F-4 was a fighting machine built just for that. Navy built them as an interceptor, but it turned out to be a marvelous conventional warfare airplane.
For Vietnam, the F-105 Thunder Chief's nuclear bomb bay was turned into a fuel tank. And the B-52, designed for long-range nuclear strikes, was modified to carry scores of conventional bombs.
30 of those B-52s were sent to Guam just before the beginning of Rolling Thunder. And the air crews thought they were going to bomb North Vietnam.
We deployed on February 11th, 1965.
Don Harton was a co-pilot in one of those bombers.
But the mission from that point was to go down to 500 feet, paralleling the coast of North Vietnam, not gaining altitude, going over Hanoi, probably 200 to 300 feet, and then pop up and vaporize the Phu Kien airfield northwest of Hanoi, about 10 miles. That is the only mission in the Vietnam War that had a chance of stopping the war before it got started.
What might have been mattered little to the men tasked with flying north. Restrictions are orders, and orders are followed.
You never work against your own country during wartime.
It's the same old thing, just like a football game. Send me in, Coach, I'm ready.
Our pilots called it the flying telephone pole, and they closed in on our aircraft at more than 2,000 miles an hour. Doing battle with the SA-2 is next on War Stories.
We cannot be defeated by force of arms. We will stand in Vietnam.
In July 1965, President Johnson announced that U.S. troop levels in Vietnam would rise to 125,000. On the 24th, two U.S. Air Force captains, Roscoe Faubert and Richard Kiern, were already at war. Cruising at 23,000 feet, 40 miles west of Hanoi, they and their F-4 Phantom were in a part of North Vietnam designated as Route Pack 6.
Where did those terms, Route Package 5, Route Package 6, come from?
They just draw a line across a map, Route Package 1 being near the DMZ, Route Package 5 and 6 being the northernmost part of North Vietnam.
Route Package 6 probably became the most heavily defended real estate anyone had ever seen.
Faubert and Kiern spotted smoke trails streaking toward the F-4. Before they could react, an SA-2 missile scored a direct hit, making them the first of many to be taken out by this weapon. After ejecting, they were both captured, and like most POWs, their treatment was brutal. Torture, limited medical treatment, and malnutrition were the norm. Only Kiern survived.
Did you ever see a missile go by?
Oh, yeah.
How big is it?
It's like they say, about like a telephone pole.
The Russian SA-2 was quite the opposite of the low-tech, pajama-wearing Viet Cong in the South. The missile contained cutting-edge technology and one of many weapons, both ours and theirs, being tested in the skies over Vietnam.
Wild Weasel was a very highly classified program, but essentially it was mating a experienced tactical fighter pilot with an electronic warfare officer. The electronic warfare officer played with his equipment to find a SAM site, to find out what it was doing, and the pilot figured out how to handle the situation.
We would keep them busy while the strike force went in.
Dave Brog was one of those electronic warfare officers, affectionately referred to as the guy in back.
You don't think about the fear, the danger, or anything else.
because you can't hesitate.
Fly on a wild weasel mission. What's the greatest vulnerability? Enemy MiGs, anti-aircraft artillery, or surface-to-air missiles?
All the above.
The SA-2 was a new threat. We had to look at it and come up with ways to beat it. Now, it took us a while. We lost a lot of airplanes initially.
In time, wild weasel flights routinely escorted strike aircraft.
The strike force typically was 16 F-105s and escorted by what was called an Iron Hand flight. The Iron Hand flight typically had two wild weasel aircraft and two F-105D single-seaters.
The weasels flew 5 minutes ahead of the strike package. Their goal, to get the bombers in and out with bombs on target. But in order to target a SAM, the site needed to turn on its radar.
So if they turned on their radars, you could actually fire back at that radar.
That's right. The SA-2 site commander could tell when he was being fired at.
We got a very dangerous cat-and-mouse game. Wild weasel crew is risking their lives to try to destroy a surface missile site before that site can destroy them.
The North Vietnamese realized what we were doing. It didn't scare them anymore because they could keep the radar off until the last minute and then put it back on.
In late December 1965, President Johnson temporarily halted the Rolling Thunder raids, hoping Ho Chi Minh would agree to talks. The North Vietnamese ignored the gesture and used the bombing pause to improve defenses and hide targets. When War Stories returns, one of our pilots pays the price.
June 1966, astronaut Edward White took America's first walk in space. That month on Mother Earth, Lyndon Johnson allowed the first Rolling Thunder strikes near Hanoi. This telephone call between Secretary of Defense McNamara and the President occurred on 6 June.
Forces are ready and weather forecasts favorable for strikes against targets 48 and 9. That's Haiphong and Hanoi.
Later in the conversation, LBJ raises concerns over a Soviet tanker that might be caught in the crossfire.
What's going to be their response?
I think it's serious, Mr. President, but I think that we have told the Russians just as clearly as we put it in writing that we have done everything possible to avoid antagonizing them in this military conflict. So if we hit the tanker, I doubt that it would lead to military action.
In the skies over Vietnam, the pilots flying the missions wondered how they could win a war if we were going to avoid antagonizing one of our enemy's principal sources of supply.
The restrictions were so ridiculous.
June 17, 1966, not a good day.
Paul Galani was off the coast of Vietnam aboard the USS Hancock, preparing for his second mission of the day.
What was the target?
The target was Than Hoa, but we couldn't get in because of the weather. Instead of going up to Than Hoa, we went in to hit the boxcars. I rolled in, and I got hit right at the bottom of the dive bombing run. And I looked down and saw the two hydraulic gauges go down to zero. And I said, nope, this is not good. The tail blew off the airplane, and I ejected. Pulled my radio out and told them I'm okay, I'm hitting the deck. And I got down, looked around, they're all coming toward me, and the last transmission was send the airplane, send the helicopters back, and I'll see you after the war. Thinking in my mind it was going to be about another 6 months.
At that point, 17th June 1965, did you know anybody who was already a POW?
A bunch of them. Yeah, my friend John Heilig is one of our photo birds. He'd been shot down. We thought he was a POW.
You didn't know for sure who was and who wasn't?
No.
Because they weren't telling anybody.
At this point in the war, the North Vietnamese refused to disclose what pilots they held in captivity. Torture and interrogation were a fact of life, as common as the sunrise. Following a shootdown, Paul's fate remained a mystery for years. When an airman went down in enemy territory, the race to rescue was on.
And the rescue people were unbelievable. The Navy would actually fly across South Vietnam to get to an Air Force pilot that had been shot down in Laos.
That's a pretty risky mission.
It is. It certainly is.
It was up to the Sandy to come in and clear the area. The Jolly Greens would come in there taking heavy fire and go down and rescue guys.
The Jolly Green giant helicopters and Sandy propeller-driven A-1 Sky Raiders were essential in many rescue missions. A World War II-era prop plane, the A-1 flew low, slow, and loaded with armament. It was great for attacking enemy ground troops searching for our downed flyers, but it was also vulnerable to ground fire.
There were two Navy pilots looking for Major Norman Schmidt.
Norman Schmidt's F-104 was shot down in Group Pack 1. When the Navy pilots ran low on gas, Air Force Sky Raider pilot Captain Hubert Nichols and his wingman took over the search.
Him and his wingman started their zigzagging pattern looking for signs or parachutes or flares, and that's when his plane was hit. And there was no other sign of my dad or no radio or parachute or anything.
I answered the door when three Air Force officers were at the door, and they came in, and my mom saw them, and she said, "Carol, take Jim out in the backyard and push him on the swing." And I was back there pushing him, and I knew something was wrong.
She was told not to talk about it because the North Vietnamese government would use any information like that and use it for propaganda.
I pretty much cried myself to sleep every night of my life when I was in grade school and high school, just thinking that he's being tortured.
I mean, I always assumed that he was captive and he was in a prison camp somewhere.
When War Stories returns, we'll take you inside one of the war's greatest deceptions. Operation Bolo is coming up.
He would call them by name. This was his standard method of gaining entry.
In January of 67, Albert DeSalvo, the so-called Boston Strangler, was sentenced to life in prison. Operation Rolling Thunder was approaching its second anniversary. Increasingly, raids to the north were being intercepted by communist MiGs. To maneuver against enemy aircraft, our heavily laden planes often had to jettison their bombs short of their intended target.
The MiGs were getting more and more aggressive.
Then Colonel Robin Olds was CO of the 8th Tactical Fighter Wing. Like most of the Air Force pilots who flew over North Vietnam, he was based in Thailand.
General Mohmeyer was there, who was my boss at 7th Air Force. He was my bullets and bombs boss. And I said, "Sir, I'm sure you know the MiGs are getting kind of frisky. I have an idea of what we could do about it."
The key to Bolo were the electronic jamming pods, newly introduced into operations.
Slung under the wing, these pods jammed enemy radars, making it harder for SAMs to lock on. In limited supply, the pods were usually hung on the Air Force's principal bomb hauler, the F-105.
We knew that their ground controllers would see these emissions from this countermeasures pod and say 105s.
So Olds put the jamming pods on the F-4s, and they went in as if they were F-105 loaded down with bombs headed for Fukien Airfield.
That was North Vietnam's major MiG base. So far, Johnson hadn't allowed it to be bombed. We could only engage MiGs in the air. But Olds figured they'd rise to defend their home base.
They were convinced it was 105, and they launched. And came up through the cloud deck behind us, and we had a nice little fight.
We didn't lose any people on our side, and the North Vietnamese lost at least seven MiGs.
I see him loud and clear.
I managed to get two that day.
As CEO of the Wolfpack, Old's most important job was preparing his men for combat.
My first batch of replacements after I got there were five guys. Not only one of them had flown real fighters before.
A lot of the most experienced air crews had already rotated home. So he was beginning to get fighter pilots who might have even been transport pilots or heavy bomber pilots.
And I looked at these kids and I said, Jesus Christ, I need fighter pilots. And they send me a bunch of guys like you. I bet you guys don't even know how to drink. Follow me. So we went to the bar.
The bar was just one of the many diversions for the air crews. Another was the mustache.
Everybody started growing. Not everybody, but boy, there were some magnificent mustaches. And what it really was kind of a joke. It was also a rigid middle digit held up in the face of the United States Air Force. Say, what are you going to do about it?
Mustaches. Do you have one?
Oh, sure. I had this mustache, and I looked meaner than hell. And I used to send around all my friends in an email and say, this is why we won the Cold War.
We all had our Australian bush hats, and every time you flew, you put a mark on it, so you keep track of how many missions you flew.
Once you flew 100 missions north, your tour of duty was supposed to be over.
A lot of the pilots I've talked to, you know, wore the same neckerchief or carried a silver dollar. Do you have any of those?
Not flying on my birthday. When I was a second lieutenant, my best friend over in England flamed out over the English Channel and ejected and died of exposure on his birthday. And I said, that's it. I'm not ever going to fly on my birthday again. And up until that point, I hadn't.
That point was March 10th, 1967, Bob Pardo's birthday, and President Johnson had authorized a new target. Like it or not, he'd be flying.
Tell me about the steel mill raid.
We started trying to hit that target on March the 1st. I think two or three times the whole strike force had to abort. We had the exact same route every day at the exact same time. And so the gunners could sit down there drinking their tea and say, okay, we've got about 5 minutes. We probably ought to get back on the gun.
Did the enemy adjust other than knowing, look, it's noon, here they come?
The first day they briefed it, if I remember correctly, within 5 miles of the steel mill, they had about 185 guns. Each day when the intelligence officer would give us his brief, it went up 100 to 150 guns. So by the 10th, he says there are roughly 1,000 guns within 5 miles of the target, and they brought in 6 mobile surface-to-air missile sites.
The ironworks sat within Route Pack 6, 35 miles north of Hanoi. Bob Pardo and his backseater Steve Wayne were about to strike one of North Vietnam's most heavily defended sites.
We were inbound to the target. We had just turned over our IP, our initial point.
And you're going from what altitude?
We had pulled up to about 14,000 feet for the roll-in. We'd released the bomb somewhere between 7,500 feet. Down we go, drop our bombs, start the pullout, and right at the bottom of the pullout, Steve and I got hit. And one of the first things we do after we come off the target is get a fuel check.
One of the other F-4s was piloted by Earl Amon. Both aircraft were hit and leaking fuel.
I was only short at that time about 2,000 pounds. But Earl, he only had 2,000 pounds remaining. And that wasn't enough gas to even get him out of North Vietnam. It's going to be really bad to sit here and watch these guys flame out and glide until they have to get out of the airplane and then see them get captured.
If Amon and his backseater Robert Houghton went down in this part of North Vietnam, there was little chance of rescue. But if they could make it to Laos, their chance of survival skyrocketed.
So I asked Earl to jettison his drag chute, and I attempted to put the nose of the airplane right in the drag chute compartment. And there was so much turbulence coming off his airplane, I couldn't get close enough to touch him. So I backed away. We dropped down underneath him, and I thought, okay, we'll try to put the top of our fuselage up against his belly and just piggybacking a little bit. We'd get within a couple of feet, and it felt like a vacuum pulling us into him. I said, well, we can't do that.
Pardo tries again, this time by pushing the crippled F-4 by its tail hook. Will Pardo's push succeed? Find out when War Stories continues. March 1967, President Johnson admits that U.S. planes are operating out of Thailand. That day over Vietnam, 72 aircraft struck the North's only ironworks. On the bomb run, an F-4 crewed by Earl Amon and Robert Houghton was crippled by enemy fire. Their tank was torn open, leaving them without the fuel they needed to get out of enemy airspace. On their wing, also flying a damaged Phantom, were Bob Pardo and Steve Wayne.
And I thought, that's just going to be really bad to sit here and watch these guys get captured.
Bob Pardo decided that he would push this other damaged aircraft out of North Vietnam so they could bail out in relative safety and be rescued.
I was looking at the bottom of his airplane and saw the tail hook. I said, okay, one last try here, put the hook down. So we eased in and put the hook in the middle of our windshield because that was the only flat spot on the front end of the airplane. He eased some power on, and sure enough, his vertical speed decreased by half. Of course, by this time, he is completely flamed out. We could hold it on there for about 30 seconds at a time, and it would slip off to the side. We just eased back a foot or two and go back in. We finally got down to about 6,000 feet, which is close to the ground as I wanted to get.
How many minutes and how many miles had it been since you were hit?
The distance involved in the push was only about 88 miles.
You're over Laos?
Yes. We watched Earl and Bob eject and saw both their parachutes open. We turned towards the tanker, but it became obvious within a minute that we weren't going to make it to the tanker.
When you ejected, did you and Steve talk, time to go?
As soon as the engines flamed out, I said, okay, Steve, it's time to go. So we got to get out. He said, I'll see you later. And he was gone.
It says a lot about the way that pilots and others tried to take care of each other, the risks that they would take to bring back a comrade.
Did any other planes go down on that mission?
Three others.
Did any of the other guys ever make it to prison?
No. There were a total of 5 airplanes shot down that day. And the 4 of us were the only ones that made it back.
On 16 May, Johnson authorized the bombing of Hanoi's power plant. He was convinced that the Navy's new TV-guided walleye bomb could score direct hits, drastically reducing the chance of unintended damage or casualties. On 19 May, the Navy made its first raid on Hanoi itself, targeting the power plant and other key enemy sites. Deep inside the infamous Hanoi Hilton, Paul Galanti and the other POWs had ringside seats.
That happens to be Ho Chi Minh's birthday. So we were under the beds for the 10th time. We're lying down there, and you hear, boom, 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 boom. And my roommate was under the bed. He goes, and every American in the entire camp cracked up, and the guards couldn't figure out what we were so happy about.
While a major step forward, the walleye, like the old dumb bombs, still relied on clear weather and daylight for accuracy.
We had almost no night capability. The only aircraft with much capability for that was the Navy A-6.
New tactics were developed in the field. George Bud Day led the unit that implemented the FASTFAC.
FAC is basically an acronym for a forward air controller. Idea being putting some eyes on the battlefield at some fairly low altitude where you could define targets and then get some 105s, F-4 bombers in to take out the targets.
They called themselves Misty Super FACs, and they flew into battle in the two-seat F-100.
A fast airplane would cruise low altitude, say 4,000 or 5,000 feet, about 510, 520 at full mill.
In late August 67, Day was sitting behind Corwin Kippenham,
They were topping off their F-100 tanks and preparing to take out a SAM site.
Kip says, I got the target. I said, I got it too. Boom, right over the target. It took this huge hit in the aft end of the airplane. The airplane just felt like it stopped. Struck the burner, got the nose up, trying to do some things to see if I could get the airplane flying again. It didn't work. Nothing to do but punch it. Bang. Don't know what happened. I just went unconscious. Within 20, 30 seconds, here was about a 13-year-old kid with a really old, rusty bolt-action rifle pointed right at my head. So I reversed the American dream, went from riches to rags and one pull of the ejection handle.
Kippenhahn was rescued, but Bud Day, badly injured, was taken prisoner.
And the next day they took me over, hung me by my feet for the entire day. Really horrible experience when your arm was all fractured up, you know, and it just was barbaric.
Rolling Thunder ends much like it began. Find out how when War Stories returns.
...1967. Protests against the war began to grow in number and size. In November that year, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara resigned.
Secretary McNamara formally resigned, but he was obviously pushed out.
It was McNamara's testimony before Congress that ended the defense secretary's tenure.
McNamara, who had persuaded him to launch the Rolling Thunder campaign to begin with, was now telling the Senate committee that the bombing campaign in North Vietnam, the Rolling Thunder campaign, was virtually worthless.
2 months after his resignation, in South Vietnam, the enemy mounted the Tet Offensive. Fierce battles raged in cities across the country, including the capital, Saigon. Removed from the safety of their jungle sanctuaries, the Viet Cong and NVA were defeated. But the military victory was lost in the court of public opinion, and LBJ had had enough too.
I shall not see, and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
He also announced that he was pulling back the bombing of North Vietnam.
After 2.5 years, over 500,000 tons of bombs dropped, 900 planes lost, and more than 1,000 airmen killed, missing or captured, Rolling Thunder finally ended in October of 68.
58,249 names on that wall. I attribute many of those to Johnson and McNamara.
Why were they called the River Rats?
They were called the River Rats because of the Red River, which goes through Hanoi.
I know what kind of kept me going on some pretty dark days. What kept you going?
My upbringing. And I would give my dad more credit. He would expect nothing but the best. That's why with Earl, I couldn't just fly away and leave him. Couldn't do it.
Decades after Bob Pardo pushed Earl Amon and Robert Houghton's F-4 to safety, Amon was stricken by a cruel, debilitating, and ultimately fatal disease.
Earl became ill with Lou Gehrig's disease. So we got busy and started raising money to get a few things he needed. He lived about 4.5 years. Lost him in 99.
The River Rats take care of their own. Today they maintain a scholarship fund for the children of military aircrew members killed in the line of duty.
We provided somewhere close to $1.6 million worth of scholarships to many, many kids.
When War Stories returns, America leaves Vietnam and our POWs come home.
In early 1973, the last American combat troops left Vietnam. 2 years later, in April of 75, the North Vietnamese Army rolled into Saigon. Some of the war's few joyous moments came in February, March, and April of 73 with the release of 591 American POWs. Among them, Paul Gulati, Bud Day, and four future members of Congress, Pete Peterson, Jeremiah Denton, Sam Johnson, and John McCain. Paul Galani endured over 6 years of hell.
We appreciate everything. We don't take stuff for granted.
He left the Navy in 1983 as a commander. Jim McInerney retired from the Air Force in 1980 with 2 stars. Robin Olds retired as a brigadier general. Dave Brogue, Jack McEncrow, and Scrappy Johnson all rose to the rank of colonel, while Bob Pardo left the Air Force as a lieutenant colonel and Don Harton as a major. After being shot down, Colonel George Bud Day spent over 5 years in captivity. For his service, he was awarded the Medal of Honor. Receiving our nation's highest honor is a close second to the day he came home to his wife Doris and their children.
I look over there, and there she is, looks like an angel. And grabbed her, and just absolutely heavenly.
I was so happy for them. It's almost like those people won a lottery ticket, because their dad is coming home.
Hubert Nichols didn't come home. His wife, Patricia, raised their 5 children alone.
I think about my dad every day. And realistically, he died in the crash.
In 1978, the military declared Colonel Nichols killed in action, body not recovered.
I wish, it's the kind of person I really wish I knew my father, other than just from stories, because it's the kind of stand-up guy you really want to know and meet.
For the American airmen who flew during Rolling Thunder, one word describes their experience: frustrating. These well-trained, remarkably brave aviators were willing to fly through enemy skies swarming with anti-aircraft fire, MiGs, and missiles. The foe they most feared? Indecision. Washington's vacillation and uncertainty in confronting a determined and ruthless enemy doomed Rolling Thunder before the first aircraft lifted off a runway or catapulted from the deck of a carrier. Yet, these young Americans still strapped in, lit their engines, checked their gauges, and flew into harm's way. The hard lessons of Rolling Thunder haven't been forgotten. Today, we no longer send 16 or 20 planes and crews to attack a target. One plane, one pilot, and one guided bomb can do the job, day or night, in almost any weather. The heroes who flew in Rolling Thunder paid a painful price to teach those lessons. Theirs is a war story that deserves to be told. I'm Oliver North. Good night.